This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. If there's a rising star in the Democratic Party today, it's the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in Illinois, Barack Obama. Chosen to give the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, Obama spoke on themes of inclusion, unity, and what he called the audacity of hope. Obama's father was from Kenya, who met his mother, a white woman from Kansas, during college. Obama is currently a state senator from Chicago. He fought a seven-way primary to get the U.S. Senate nomination, winning a remarkable 53% of the vote. What's excited party leaders and caught the attention of analysts is his ability to win in white neighborhoods, apparently connecting with voters of all backgrounds. The Senate race in Illinois took a surprising turn when the Republican candidate, Jack Ryan, dropped out after salacious details of his divorce from his wife, actress Jeri Ryan, became public. Last Sunday, the Illinois Republican Party chose conservative commentator Alan Keyes as their new candidate, and we'll speak to him later in the hour. Back in 1996, before he'd ever run for office, Barack Obama published a memoir of his life in search for racial identity called Dreams from My Father. It's been updated and is being republished this week. I spoke to Barack Obama on Tuesday. We began by talking about his family background.
Well, you know, my father was part of that first generation of Africans who traveled to the United States to get an education. Their plan was to return to their country, bring back technology, sort of like Promethean fire, to help develop these newly independent countries. He met my mother in Hawaii at the University of Hawaii while they were both studying. And this is in the early 60s. And so, you know, obviously at that time, mixed marriage was illegal in much of the country, but Hawaii, because of its cultural diversity and you know, the unique status that it had as an island state, I think was more accommodating. Nevertheless, the strains and tensions of the two cultures, I think, led my parents to separate relatively young. So he returned to Kenya after studying at Harvard. I did not end up knowing him particularly well. My mother remarried an Indonesian. I moved to Jakarta. And you know, my memories, both of Hawaii and Jakarta, I think, were significant in my ongoing development. Hawaii, because it is such a cultural melting pot, probably unique in the United States for having so many different competing cultures, none of which are dominant or assertive. But it taught me, I think, the possibilities of different cultures living side by side. Indonesia, just because it was a fascinating country, and for a six-year-old boy running around rice paddies and riding water buffalo and dealing with, you know, all the excitement and also challenges of a third-world country in the late 60s, I think was to have a significant mark on my life for many years to come, particularly the huge gaps in wealth that existed there. I think it made me more mindful of not only my blessings as a U.S. citizen, but also the ways that fate can determine the lives of young children so that one ends up being fabulously wealthy and another ends up being extraordinarily poor.
You wrote that your mom became aware of power and how it can be used to abuse people. And you also write, your mom thought it was important to instill in you values of honesty and fairness, and that you write that her only ally in all this was the distant authority of your father. You wrote that she told you that you have her to thank for your eyebrows, but your brains and your character you got from him. What was the image of your father that you carried for all those years of your youth?
Well, you know, that's one of the finest gifts that my mother ever gave me. I think a lot of parents, when they separate, there's a lot of bitterness there. And partly just because my mother's wonderful spirit, partly because my father was this very imposing, almost mythic figure, not only to my mother, but to the people that he met during the brief time he was in Hawaii. He ended up becoming this figure of great authority. You know, he was famous for his intelligence and his charm and his loquaciousness. And as a consequence, you know, I ended up having this extraordinarily positive image of being black, and that there was no reason to think that the stereotypes that, you know, I would learn subsequently about African-Americans that were still rampant and to some degree still are rampant ever applied to me.
You eventually returned to Hawaii and were raised in large part by your white grandparents, your mom's parents. But as I read the memoir, it was clear that by high school, you clearly had an identity as a Black American. And I wonder, do you feel that that was a choice you made, or that it was made by the world you inhabited? Did American culture make that choice for you?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think that, as I said before, my attitude about being Black was always positive. The associations within my family were positive. And so it wasn't something that I was fearful of or disturbed by. You know, when I was an awkward teen, you know, the trouble I had didn't have to do with being Black. It had to do with the fact that I had this funny name, Barack Obama, and you know, you always want to fit in. You wish your name was Tim Smith, but certainly the society had something to do with it as well. You know, recently, now that I've been getting a lot of attention in the political arena. There are a number of commentators who've asked me about, well, you know, you're half white. Why do you call yourself African American? I give two responses. One, I think the term African American already describes a hybrid culture. We are a hybrid people. We are a people that are native to this country and partake of all the cultural cross currents that exist. The second thing is the fact that if I'm trying to catch a cab in Manhattan, you know, the drivers are looking at me and they're saying, well, there's a Black guy out there hailing a cab. You know, that's an identity that I welcome and embrace, and it's a tradition that I draw from. I don't feel it's something that I need to shy away from. And I don't feel that it's contradictory to take that position and still embrace the fact that I had this wonderful side of my family that was white, and the values that they instilled in me are ones that I still care about, precisely because I don't think they're white or Black values, but I think they're human values.
So you grew up largely in Hawaii, and you had this image of your dad as a man of enormous accomplishment and character, which your mom had kept in your mind. And then
right.
There was one real visit that he made when you were 10. What are your recollections of that?
Well, you know, what was remarkable, and I devote a chapter of the book to this, is the degree to which he somehow was able to live up to these images that I had. He was imposing, and he was impressive, and he did sort of change the space around him when he walked into a room. I didn't know at the time, and would only know subsequently when I traveled to Kenya and met my family there, that he was actually struggling and having an enormously difficult time. But his capacity to establish an image for himself of being in command was in full force. And had an impressive effect on a 10-year-old boy. It was funny, later in life, you know, I would realize how much that brief visit and interaction with him altered me in all sorts of ways, some of which I don't even notice, but my mother would notice later. You know, habits of how I speak, or you know, how I gesture, and it just reminds you, I think, of what a powerful force parents are in their children's lives.
You studied at a prep school in Hawaii that you were lucky enough to get into, which it seems like it was not an easy time. And it seems like the time when you were in high school seems to be the one episode in your life when you seemed to lose some motivation and your grades slipped and, you know, you smoked marijuana with your buddies. And I'm kind of wondering, what, in retrospect, what was going on then? What was troubling you?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things going on. One is the absence of a father, I think, has the most profound effect on teenage boys, because it's right at that time where they're dealing with hormones and they're trying to figure out, you know, how do I assert myself in this world, and who am I? And you know, when you don't have clear models, you start trying to pick models off the rack, that's a period in time where I think I fell into the trap that a lot of African American youth fall into, and that is these exaggerated stereotypes about how I should behave, that I should rebel against academic achievement, or I should concentrate all my attention on sports, or I should dabble in drugs. And it wasn't until I reached college that I started recognizing that I had bought into a set of false assumptions about what it meant to be black. But part of it, you know, the culture was powerful. I mean, keep in mind, this is a time when, you know, Shaft and Superfly and, you know, that's one alternative. And then the other alternative is Flip Wilson in a wig. You know, if you had to choose between those two, you know, Shaft seemed to be the better deal. I don't want to overstate this, because I think in a lot of ways I wasn't that different from a lot of teenage kids growing up in the 70s, which is, it was a difficult time for the country generally.
So you graduate high school, you go to college in Los Angeles, Occidental College, if I recall.
Right.
And eventually you make contact with one of your sisters from Kenya. Alma,
right.
Do I have her name correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And you eventually get together for a several-day meeting. And it's interesting to me that for a while you don't talk about your father. Then eventually the time is right. And she tells the story, the kind of the story that you haven't heard about your dad. And tell us what she told you and what its effect was on you.
Well, what was fascinating was to hear her speak. She had studied in Germany, was visiting me while I was actually had moved to Chicago by this time. I'd graduated from Columbia University in New York, had worked for an organizer for about 6 months, had moved to Chicago to continue community organizing work out in the far south side of Chicago, working with churches that were trying to deal with the devastation of steel plants closing in the area. And she made contact and came to visit me in Chicago. And it was at that point that I learned that my father had a very troubled life. He had passed away at this point. I'd gotten a call while I was in New York that he had been killed in a car accident. When she came to visit, she explained to me that upon his return to Kenya, he had ended up being caught up with the government in Kenya, but had a falling out in part because he was somebody who was willing to speak out against corruption and nepotism in the government administration there, had been blackballed from the government, had ended up having a alcoholism problem at the same time as he had fallen on very hard times, and so had gone from being a big man with an American education who was prominent in the government to somebody who had to borrow from relatives to support his children, the children that he had from other marriages in Kenya. And so this image that I had of this very strong, powerful, imposing figure was suddenly balanced by this picture of a very tragic figure who had never been able to really pull all the pieces of his life together again. And, you know, that was a disquieting revelation, obviously, and had to make me reexamine, you know, how high I had been thinking about him and what my expectations were of him. And I think also forced me to grow up a little bit. You know, one of the things that all of us have to face sometime in our lives is the realization that our parents are mortal and fallible. And in some ways, that was delayed for me when it comes to thinking about my father, because he wasn't around, so you didn't have a chance to see him age or cry or have difficulties.
Or struggle.
And really, my sister did see that happen to him in those ways, It really I think, shook me up, ultimately in a healthy way.
It's almost as if holding on to the myth was more important.
Or important,
in some way.
You know, certainly more important to my family. I mean, what, you know, what's striking was what a vigorous defense they would always mount to my father. And I think that is a testimony to him in some fashion, because he really did change their lives. I mean, keep in mind that...
Your Kenyan family, you mean?
Well, no, I'm talking about my mother's family.
Okay.
You know, I think that, you know, there was an important transaction that took place between my mother's family and my father, in the sense that, you know, they offered to him some sort of entree into the modern world or to the Western world. But the flip side of it was is that he drew them out of the parochialism and ordinariness of a Midwestern Kansas existence. He made their lives different and exciting, and suddenly they had a grandchild who spoke to, Kennedy's New Frontier and Dr. King's magnificent dream. I think that was critical for them as well, certainly critical to my mother, who was somebody who, as a child, I think was always sensing that there was a bigger world out there that somehow she had to access. And she accessed it initially through my father.
Going back to the moment when your sister Alma kind of told you the details of the difficulties your father had had, and you'd realized, I think you said, your gramps, you were used to other people being flawed, but not right. Not Dr. Obama.
I think that it in some ways it was liberating, because I didn't realize how much I had been trying to chase after his ghost, right? That I'd been arguing with somebody who in fact didn't exist. There was probably some sense of relief there. But I think it also made me question myself in all sorts of ways, because you often are concerned that if your parents have these flaws, goodness, I'm going to have these flaws too. It's like the big ears I inherited from my grandfather, the bad back or what have you. You worry that there are elements of their character that have seeped into you unbeknownst to you, and you've got to figure out how you're going to cope with those things. And so, I think both things were operating, and it wasn't until I returned to Kenya and had a chance to stand at his grave and my grandfather's grave in a small village named Alego, near Lake Victoria, and wept for him, and understood his journey and my grandfather's journey, and also understood that the best in him wasn't all that different from the best in my white grandfather from Kansas. The values that connected my mother and my father were values that I could embrace. That I didn't have to choose between them. It wasn't until that point that I think I was able to come to terms with them.
You're now married. You have a wife, Michelle, two small kids. And, we all wonder to what extent we're going to become our parents. And I wondered, as I read about how you discovered that your father, who, you'd always thought of as a man of great character and accomplishments and truly was, turned out to be a guy who, had a polygamy in his past and a tough stretch with some drinking issues. And I'm wondering, do you ever worry whether you'll be able to remain? Does it make you concerned that you won't be able to remain the kind of committed husband and father that I'm sure you want to be?
Lyndon Johnson, who I don't quote that often, had this wonderful saying. He says, every man is trying to live up to his father's expectations or make up for his mistakes. And I guess I'm trying to do both. My father set some high expectations for me and for himself that he couldn't always meet, and I'm trying to live up to those high standards, but also make up for the mistakes that he made, particularly with respect to his family life.
It's interesting you mentioned LBJ, because he's an example of a politician, as are a lot of very successful politicians, who are rooted in a place. I mean, we know he is a Texan. We know that Harry Truman came from Missouri. Your past seems almost rooted in ideas. I mean, diversity, inclusion, hope. Or is Chicago really your home?
At this point, Chicago really is my home. I mean, the middle section of the book is about Chicago, and that's really where I found my manhood, and I found my home and my roots. Because the African American community in Chicago is a wonderfully rich and funky area, and the community that we live in on the south side of Chicago is full of traditions and a strong African-American political history, a strong African-American cultural and religious history. And it's really provided me with a base of support, a family, a network that I'm just grateful for every day. And it's the community where my wife grew up. It's a community where we go to church and we raised our kids. And so at this point, I feel very much rooted in that community. But as I've said before, I'm not limited by that community. And I certainly think that one of the gifts that I may bring to bear in my politics is the ability to span across cultures in a way that I think is going to be increasingly important. In an age where not only within our borders but outside our borders, there are a lot of conflicting cultures that have to be drawn together.
One of the lines that was most quoted from your convention speech was your exhortation to eradicate the slander that says a black youth with a book is acting white. I'm wondering, I think at times in your career have been regarded by some African-American politicians as a guy who isn't really a black politician, but sort of some exotic character who, kind of white middle class folks like to like. How have you confronted that issue?
What's fascinating is it's never been an issue among regular folks on the street. It's never an issue with the bus drivers or the teachers or the guys on the street corner who I'm talking to. This is always an issue that's been brought up in the context of a political situation by professional politicians. And it's a handy shorthand to try to create some separation between me and what's a strong part of my base. But it really is not something that has ended up being a problem for me with respect to the voters. We got 90% of the African-American vote in this recent primary, and the turnout was, I think, 30% higher than it had been in the previous election within the African-American community. So clearly they felt that what I was articulating spoke to their lives and their concerns.
Well, one person hopes to find you another way to make a living is Alan Keyes. The Republicans have selected the conservative Alan Keyes to run against you for the Senate seat. And he's come right after you. He accused you, I believe I read, of holding the slaveholder's position on life, a reference to your position on abortion. He's coming after you. What kind of campaign do you expect?
Well, let's see. He's been here 2 days, and so far he's compared me to slaveholders, Nazis, and has justified him coming in from Maryland by comparing the situation in New York after 9/11, suggesting that we were all New Yorkers then, and in the same way, he's an Illinoisan now in doing battle with me. That's Mr. Keyes's style. Rhetorical styles. But I'll be honest with you. We're going to do the same things that we've been doing throughout. What people really want to see are politicians who attack problems instead of each other. I think people are just weary of this sort of scorched earth, slash and burn politics that demonizes whoever doesn't agree with you. And Democrats, by the way, are complicit in that. I always tell my supporters and my fellow Democrats, or not even Democrats, just people of goodwill who want to see the country move in a better direction, we lose when we engage in that sort of mudslinging. The people that I care about lose, because those are the people, the ordinary folks are most apt to be alienated from the process in that kind of political environment. The people who thrive in those political environments are the professionals. They're the ruthless and the cynical and the people who've got a monetary stake in outcomes and are going to be working the back rooms and the corridors no matter what happens. So I am going to, I'm going to engage Mr. Keyes in a debate on jobs and education and healthcare, and I think that I'm entirely happy to engage with him on a discussion about some of the issues that he's concerned about, issues of abortion or gay rights or, you know, wanting to, you know, have the Ten Commandments posted in a federal courtroom. You know, I'm happy to talk about those things, but what I'm going to insist on is that we discuss issues not only of private morality, but also public morality, because I think that there are moral questions posed when, you know, we have one out of every three African-American males in prison, and there are moral problems that are posed when entire communities are devastated because the plant closes and is moving overseas. And there are moral problems posed by all those stakeholders in Enron when nobody's policing them. And that's going to be as big of a topic as issues like gay marriage in this campaign, if I have anything to do about it.
Do you think the Democratic Party needs to be more aggressive? I mean, there are people that know, for example, 4 years ago, that the Black Congressional Caucus wanted to challenge the Supreme Court's ruling on the election, the Gore-Bush election. Not a single senator stood with them. I mean, do you think the Democratic Party needs to be more aggressive?
Well, what I think is that the Democratic Party makes a mistake when it gets steamrolled by conservative politicians and then whines about it afterwards. You know, that seems to be a habit that we've had over the last several years, whether with respect to the tax cuts or the war in Iraq or the Patriot Act. We cave and then we complain afterwards, in which case we look not only weak but also petty. And my general way of operating has been to stand firm and be clear on the front end about what I believe in, and to ask tough questions and to put forward my agenda. But once I've done that, that puts me in a position where I can reach across the aisle and see if I can find common ground with people who disagree with me. And I think that kind of constructive debate is always useful. You know, when I talk about positive campaigns or positive politics, you know, I'm not referring to mealy-mouthed split-the-difference politics, because I think that's failed. I think there has to be a robust debate on all these issues. And what I am constantly suggesting, though, is that we can disagree vigorously on issues without accusing the other side of bad faith or suggesting that somehow they are evil or that they are trying to do harm to people in our party. You know, my sense is that we can disagree and still recognize ourselves and each other and have some empathy for the other person's position.
Senator Barack Obama, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Illinois State Senator Barack Obama. He's currently the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate from Illinois.